calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday, the first hour of our three-hour program, and therefore time for Brunch with Bernie, Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives, and the longest-serving independent member of the House of Representatives as well. His website, bernie.org, information about him over there, and also tomhartman.com. Of course, you can find information about us in this program, as well as links to Bernie and links to our chat room, our live chat room, and to our live message board where you get more information. Our toll-free number, 866-440-THOM. 440-8466. We'll be taking your calls with Bernie in just a few minutes. But Congressman Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here, Bernie. You in Washington today?
Nope, back in Burlington.
Back in Burlington.
Started last night.
Wonderful. I'm sure the people of Vermont are pleased about that. You're doing a great job there. Bernie, what's on your plate for the day?
Well, I think everybody knows or should know that we are about 7 weeks away from what I think, Tom, will be one of the very, very most important elections in American history. And that has to do with whether or not we end one-party reactionary government in Washington and start moving this country in a very different direction. You know, Tom, last week, I don't know if you saw it, there was a front-page piece in the Washington Post, which I think says about all that has to be said about this coming election. And let me quote what it says. It says that Republicans are planning to spend the vast majority of their sizable financial war chest over the final 60 days of the campaign attacking Democratic House and Senate candidates over personal issues and local controversies, GOP officials said. The National Republican Congressional Committee, which this year dispatched a half dozen operatives to comb through tax, court, and other records looking for damaging information on Democratic candidates, plans to spend more than 90% of its $50 million-plus advertising budget on what officials described as negative ads, end quote. In other words, when you have a party which has total control over our government and which has moved us in the wrong direction in terms of the national debt, in terms of the outsourcing of good-paying jobs, when they have done nothing about health care, and in fact, since Bush has been president, 6 million more Americans have lost their health insurance, when these people are essentially ignoring the crisis of global warming, when they want to privatize Social Security, when they want to cut back on veterans' funds, when they continue with no plan whatsoever, the war in Iraq, and have no idea as to when and how our troops can come home, when gas and home heating oil prices are higher than they have been for many, many years, what will the Republicans be doing? They will be engaging in massive negative campaigns, attacking, you know, candidates and waging wars of personal destruction because they want to deflect attention away from their abysmal record. That's the way Karl Rove and these guys do business, and we have got to take them on every step of the way, and we have got to defeat them.
Amen. Amen. And the stakes are not just about political power or, you know, my side, your side. The stakes are the future of working people in the United States.
The stakes are even beyond that. I mean, it's not only whether or not the middle class is going to survive, whether poverty is going to increase. It's virtually whether this planet, in terms of environmental degradation, is going to be sustained. You have a Republican chairman of the Environmental Committee in the Senate, a guy named Mr. Inhofe, who literally believes, has made public his view, that global warming is one of the great hoaxes ever perpetrated on the American people. You have leadership there which believes in the outsourcing of good-paying jobs. They're very open about it. If a company can make more money by moving to China and hiring people there at 30 cents an hour, go for it. What's the problem? You have, as of today, you have the Republican leadership and the president fighting tooth and nail to repeal the estate tax and give another $700 billion in tax breaks to the wealthiest two-tenths of 1% of the American people, and in doing that drive up the debt that we're going to be leaving to our kids and our grandchildren. You will have the president being very clear that he will come back if these guys retain control with efforts to destroy and privatize Social Security. So the agenda for these people continues to be right-wing extremism. And because they have nothing to say, because they really don't want to debate the important issues facing ordinary people, what they will do, as they always do, is deflect attention away from those issues and get into wars of personal destruction. And that's what they are doing from one end of this country to the other. It's a kind of politics which, to my mind, is obscene. And we have got to force them to talk about the real issues. And we have got to knock on doors all over this country, and we have got to win back control over the House and the Senate. And the stakes are just enormous, not only for our generation, but for our kids and grandchildren as well.
Bernie, we saw in Rhode Island over this week in the primary, the Republican Party basically just kind of dropped down out of outer space. I mean, just boom, the machine lands, millions of dollars come with it. Instantly, there's people on the ground, there's phone banks running, there's a media machine running, just wham, like that. And never before in the history of Rhode Island had more than 40,000 people voted in a primary, and they had 60,000 people vote in this primary, and Lincoln Chafee won. Now, Lincoln Chafee, you know, is not a supporter of the president, but they want to keep that 51 vote majority in the Senate,
right,
so that there's no possibility that their programs can be derailed.
Right.
And I'm just, you know, the Republican Party's got $60 million sitting in their back pocket with no specific allocation, just to do these single district, single state drop.
Let me make two points, and using Rhode Island is a good example. Believe me, Lincoln Chafee is not the worst of the Republicans down there. But the reason, in fact, on some occasions has stood up to the president, but the reason that the right-wing Republican leadership poured millions of dollars into his campaign is they know that on the most important issue that Lincoln will cast, and that is who controls the United States Senate, he is going to vote for the Republicans. He did not do what Jim Jeffords did, and say that he would, you know, leave the Republican Party and be an independent. So they poured millions of dollars. That's issue number one, and everybody should understand that. The most important issue that any member of the Congress or the Senate votes on is not health care, it's not the environment, it's not the war in Iraq. It is who controls the body. Because who controls the body determines what the agenda will be, what the priorities will be, what legislation will be voted on. Lincoln Chafee will vote for the right-wing Republican leadership. Number two, you make a very good point, is that while the Republicans spend very little time and energy worrying about public policy, worrying about how we stop the decline of the middle class, how we have health care for all, how we end the war in Iraq, that's not their thing. They're not very good at that. They don't care about it. They really don't believe very much the government should do much for the American people. But what they are very, very good at, and what Karl Rove is, of course, a genius at, is politics and how you win elections. So as I mentioned earlier, what they will be spending tens of millions of dollars on are negative advertising. They're very good at trying to destroy people, but they are also very good in making sure that they bring out every vote that they possibly can. Which leads me to a very important point, that those people who are listening, who are serious about the future of this country, have also got to be involved in grassroots, day-to-day politics. And that means knocking on doors. That means that one makes sure that we have, for our side, the largest voter turnout that we possibly can. The truth is, I think it is pretty well acknowledged the Republicans now do this better than anybody else. But this stuff is really not rocket science. It just means identifying all of who your supporters are and making sure that you get them out to vote. And we have got to do that very, very well. But in your point is well taken. The Republicans are excellent at doing that.
Yeah. Now, in Oregon, where I live, just this story just came out of the Loaded Oregon blog, that this guy got a phone call from a GOP person on behalf of a candidate, And here's the message. In fact, he recorded it. Hello, I'm calling on behalf of Oregon Right to Life. Now, this is a nonprofit organization. They're not supposed to engage in politics. We are calling on behalf of Everett Curry, pro-life candidate running for the Oregon legislature. If you'd be willing to put up a lawn sign in support of Everett Curry, please call. And there's the phone number. And then when they checked his caller ID to see where the number came from, it was a church organization in Canby, Bob Kreider Team Ministries. This, already they're doing this kind of stuff illegally, Bernie.
Yeah, well, I mean, yep, and that will not be the last time either, I fear.
Yeah, but we just, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty, right?
That's right, and that means we've got to work harder than they do.
Our number, 866-440-8466. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
Political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us today. And Tom in Eugene, Oregon on the line. Hey, Tom, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi. I have a simple question. The proposal by Bush, the tribunal proposal, which is the mad dictator sort of proposal, I was just wondering if that's a trick to make Warner and McCain look good. In other words, to distance them from him for the next election. That's my main question.
Hmm.
And
interesting question, Tom. Bernie, I've been predicting for some time that if Bush's popularity stayed low, that Republican candidates, with his permission, would start running against him, just because you know he doesn't want to lose the majority in the House and the Senate.
Well, Tom, that's a fact. That's not a prediction. That's not a guess. The Republican leadership has made it very clear in Washington. They want Republican candidates to distance themselves from the president and from Republican leadership. That's happening all over this country. So that's not speculation. That's a fact. Their job is to win elections. And if it means being critical of the president, distancing himself all over in Vermont and all over this country, you're finding candidates like President Bush. Who is that? Gee, my goodness, I never heard of that guy. But that's part of their plan, surely. Yeah.
Yeah. Indeed. And, we'll see how it shakes
out. I mean, the congressional leadership now is just almost at an all-time low. People are very upset about the do-nothing Congress. And so certainly the Republicans will be telling their candidates to stay away from them.
Yeah. Tony in New York City, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Great show, guys.
Thanks.
Bernie, I have a question. With the NAFTA Act, and I know you were talking about the economy earlier on, I think.
Yes.
Don't you think NAFTA really was a horrible thing, though, for this country?
Yes. I voted against NAFTA, which is the North American Free Trade Agreement, and was one of the leaders against NAFTA. But, Tony, it's not just NAFTA. It is our entire trade policies. And one of the things that is very annoying to me is that the media does a very bad job in talking about trade policies, which do not sound like a very sexy issue, but, in fact, are a very important issue. If we want to understand why the middle class is shrinking, why most of the new jobs being created in my state of Vermont and throughout this country are low-wage jobs, often without very good benefits. One of the reasons is our disastrous trade policies, which includes NAFTA, but even more important, permanent normal trade relations with China. You know, I know that many young people, when they go shopping and they buy their products, and many of those products are made in China, they don't blink an eye. They think, well, yeah, that's the way it always was, of course. Well, let me tell the young people, there was once a time, not so many years ago, when in the United States of America we actually produced a lot of products. We had real manufacturing jobs. In the last 5 years, and certainly NAFTA and PNTR with China are one of the reasons, we have lost close to 3 million good-paying jobs. Our entire automobile industry is now being threatened by imports that will soon be coming in to China. So one of the issues that Congress has got to address against the very powerful corporate interests is radically revising our trade policies so they protect American workers and not just the CEOs of large corporations who would just as soon throw American workers out on the street, move to China, hire people there at 50 cents an hour, and bring those products back into the country. So, Tony, yeah, NAFTA is a huge issue, but we've got to take a hard look at our entire trade policy, rebuild manufacturing in America, protect white-collar information technology jobs as well, because if we don't begin to look at that issue, we're going to lose those jobs equally.
And apropos that, Bernie, today Ford announced that they're offering buyouts to all 70,000 of their domestic employees. They're expecting about a third of them are going to take it, a $140,000 lump sum, and you give up your retirement health benefits.
But that's a tragedy, but it really speaks to the decline of manufacturing in America. And there are many economists, Tom, who argue that you can't be a major economic power if you are not producing the products that people need. And it's not, you know, believe me, it's not just sneakers anymore, socks. It's high-tech military equipment, which is increasingly being made abroad. It is corporation after corporation running to China as fast as they can.
And we're giving them tax incentives to do it.
And we are giving them corporate welfare and tax incentives to do it. And this is just a real vicious attack against the middle class of this country. I remember I'm on the Financial Services Committee in the House, and I always remember I wish there was a C-SPAN camera there, you know, in efforts that, you know, I was trying to make to stop corporate welfare for some of the largest outsources in America. And Republican leadership says, sure, you want to send jobs to China, throw American workers out on the street? No problem. And come to Washington. We'll give you billions in corporate welfare. You have the heads of large corporations making it very clear that that's their intention, and then they get taxpayer support nonetheless. Pretty crazy stuff.
Yeah, and a few of them still call themselves Americans. I don't know how they can do it.
Right.
Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. I think of him as America's congressman. With us, our Brunch with Bernie hour. We'll be back with your calls right after this, 27 minutes past the hour.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Viagra for your brain! But just don't tell Limbaugh. He'll want some. Welcome back. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Yeah, that probably wasn't the most distinguished thing to say before I introduce a Congressman Bernie. I'm sorry. Glad to have you back with us. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes. Happy Friday, Tom and Bernie.
Thank you.
I had two questions, Bernie, and your screener suggested I ask the second one first, which is, what did you make of this trip that the, I'm not sure if it was the prime minister or president of Iraq, went over to Iran to meet with
the prime minister.
Well, there you go. President Bush has been busy telling us about the potential threats that we may have from Iran and the threat of nuclear weapons being developed there. And then we have Iraq becoming closer to Iran. So I think that is an issue of real concern. And one of the real fears that we have is the degree to which Iran is going to be developing influence in Iraq. So I think it is an issue of concern.
And that really isn't too surprising, is it, since the populations of both countries are predominantly Shiite, and of course I guess Saddam was
No, but Rick, this is the first time in 300 years that there's been an official state visit between these two countries.
Is that right?
Well, I've read that in two different sources. I don't say that as a scholar of the area, but yeah, that's
300.
Yeah, that's
amazing.
For official, you know, I mean, they rolled out a red carpet for this guy.
Oh, so
anyway,
much for...
but Rick, you had another question for Bernie.
Yeah. The big news now and coming out of the news conference, which I don't know if either one of you two fellows heard from the president. There's some questions mainly about this revolt, apparently, within Bush's own party. You know, respected Republicans such as John Warner, John McCain, and Lindsey Graham openly defying the president even after he lobbied to have this thing passed, and now he's getting real petulant about it and saying, well, go ahead and do this, and then I'll just end it. And, you know, apparently, I guess, implying that if more Americans die as a result of this, it'll be those Republicans' fault.
You're taking this, Bernie?
Yeah, well, you know, I think, and not only McCain and Warner and Graham, but you're hearing Colin Powell beginning to speak out. And I think the real fear here is that if you ignore or don't pay attention to the Geneva Convention, what I think a lot of these people appropriately understand is that American soldiers could be in danger as well. If you were allowed to torture, if you're allowed to do terrible things to prisoners, then why won't other countries say that they have the right to do the same thing to American soldiers? So I think you're seeing a rebellion against the president's view on these issues.
Yeah. And the other point is you get lousy intelligence. John McCain tells the story of how when he was tortured in Vietnam, he gave them the names of the Green Bay Packers, offensive line you get lousy intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Chris in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Chris.
Hello. I would like to know, you introduced him as an independent. Why aren't you a Democrat?
Well, I've never been a Democrat. I was elected mayor of the city of Burlington, our largest city, on four occasions as an independent, and I've been elected to the U.S. House of Representatives 8 times as an independent. And I have differences of opinion with the Democrats on this or that issue. I think that what we have right now in America is that the Republican Party is an extreme right-wing party. I think that the Democrats, in many instances, although there are great people there who I work with very closely, Congress members, the Progressive Caucus, for example.
Which you helped found.
Which I helped found, right, with Democrats. That in many instances the Democrats are not strong enough in standing up for working families. So I'm comfortable being an independent. I will, if elected to the Senate, I will be doing as I did in the House, and that is work closely with the Democratic leadership, certainly support the Democratic leadership in their effort to regain control. And on this or that issue, I will work with Republicans. But I'm proud to be an independent.
Ken in Bloomington, Illinois, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning and good afternoon, depending on which side of the country you're on. This is my favorite hour of the week. Bernie, what I want to know, and you kind of alluded to it earlier, the dismal job that our news people are doing, is why aren't we bringing up our national debt? As a breadwinner, which makes, you know, as a taxpayer, I'm one of the breadwinners of this country, it appalls me how deeply we are going into debt, how much more money we're spending than we're making. If that were a headline, a 1 or a 2 or a 13 with 21 zeros behind it, which is about how far deep in debt we are, the interest on that is more than our tax dollars every year, I believe. It's why is this a secret?
Well, I mean, it's not a secret. I mean, everybody knows that the national debt is, well, not everybody, I should say. Your point is well taken, Ken. Not enough people know that the national debt is over $8 trillion. That it has grown well over $2 trillion since Bush has been in office, that every man, woman, and child in our country owes about $28,000, and that in the midst of all of this, we have a president and a congressional leadership that want to provide hundreds of billions more in tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires, which will only drive up that national debt even more. But I think it gets back to a point that I made, you know, maybe at the beginning of this show, is that to a significant degree, you have a Republican leadership, which often is able, through the president, to drive the media into discussing what they want to discuss rather than the really important issues facing America. National debt is a huge issue. The interest payments that we pay out every year means that that is money not going into education, not going into environmental protection, not going into the needs of our seniors. But that is going money going out in many instances to foreign debt holders in Japan, China, and elsewhere. So you're quite right. This is an issue that should be focused on, and not enough attention is being paid to it.
Charles in Hillsboro, Ohio. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Thank you. Congressman Bernie, I need to know what we're going to do to hold this cabal accountable for the treasonous actions that they've taken, such as stealing two elections and the Valerie Plame incident. I find those incidents to be treasonous, and the other criminal actions that they've perpetrated against the citizens of the planet and the United States. What are we going to do to hold them accountable? It's not good enough that we get them out of power.
Well, it is good enough that we get them out of power. I mean, it's a good start, because you're not going to accomplish much else if you don't get them out of power. But people very often say, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Well, the answer is nothing is going to happen so long as the Republicans continue to control the House, the Senate, and the White House. They will determine the agenda. They determine what types of hearings or investigations take place. So I would say very strongly, Charles, that in the next 7 weeks, the goal is, in fact, to end one-party government in the United States, to make sure that there are committee chairpersons who are prepared to ask the right questions and start holding the White House accountable. But what I can assure you, if there is not a change in the House or the Senate, that is not going to happen.
Armin in Sarasota, Florida on the line. Hey, Armin, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Okay, Bernie, Tom Hartman. You're both fine people, and the clock's ticking down to the election. Okay, listen carefully. Nancy Pelosi. Okay, the Republicans are putting up their theatrics about the fence on the border. What does Nancy say yesterday? She says, I oppose the fence. Even the Homeland Security opposes it. What I'm trying to say quickly is they're putting up smoke and mirrors, Republicans, for suckers. And what we need to do is you need to get a hold of the Democrats and say, you guys want to win this and take it back, or you want to be beholden forever to your corporate masters. What do you want to do? The people right now, there's such a vacuum out there that if the Democrats say, okay, look, the
Armin, let me interrupt you. Is there a question for Bernie in there?
Yeah, the Republicans have been in for 12 years. Why don't the Democrats bring out a report card on the 12 years that the Republicans been in there?
Okay,
good
one. Because you're always, Armin, you're always welcome to give a speech when I'm on the air, but right now we're asking questions of Bernie. Bernie?
Well, Armin, I mean, I think in many ways that is what some of the Democratic leaders are precisely trying to do, and I think in almost every important area, if you give the Republican leadership a grade on the major issues facing our country, that grade is going to be a D or an F. And that's what this campaign is about. They have control over the House, the Senate, and the White House. If people think this country is moving in the right direction, vote Republican. But if you think that they are not, in terms of the economy, health care, the environment, the war in Iraq, how we treat our veterans, education, it's time to throw them out of power. And that is precisely what this election is about.
Zach in Kenosha, Wisconsin, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Gentlemen, it's always a distinct honor to speak to both of you.
Thank you.
Hey, Tom, I'm going to try to catch a book signing out in California. You can be in L.A., correct?
Yeah, that's in a week or so. I'm in San Francisco right now broadcasting live from the Quake. I'm doing 3 book signings in the Bay Area today. Tomorrow and actually, yeah, tonight and tomorrow. Is tonight in San Francisco, tomorrow in Corte Madera and Berkeley. It's all over at TomHartman.com. But your question for Bernie.
Congressman, or should I say future senator, it's always a pleasure. All right, quickly, do the Democrats have the strength and the finances to, after this November election, to take the results to court? Because I suspect we're going to lose. We're going to lose like we did the other two elections, and are we prepared to fight through it, take it up to the Supreme Court? The second thing is, $8 billion in cold hard cash. Or is it? How come nobody's talking about it? How come we're not investigating it?
You're talking about missing in Iraq.
$8 billion
missing in Iraq. Okay, well, Bernie,
exactly.
You can pick up these questions on the other side of the break.
Okay.
All righty, we'll do it. Zach, thanks a lot for calling. Our number 866-440-8466. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
One for all, it's all, it's all.
And welcome back to listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman radio program. And the way listeners can support the program is by supporting our sponsors. Support the sponsors you hear on your local affiliates and as well as our national sponsors, Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. SacredGroundsCoffee.com, their website, their telephone number, 1-800-425-2532. Small Dog Electronics. Get the latest iPods now. 1-800-511-MAX at smalldog.com. And the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE and ecowine.com, the website. We're back with Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Ruth Ann in New Albany, Indiana. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Congressman Sanders. I've been seeing and hearing some of the propaganda from the administration about how the debt is actually coming down, the deficit's coming down, and there may even be a surplus, but yet I know I have heard that they are not revealing all the figures. Can you enlighten me on that?
Well, two things, Ruth Ann. One of the things that they do virtually every year is they make a prediction about how large the deficit will be, and they always overstate it. And then what they do is when it comes in less than what they had predicted, they say, see, this is the good news. We had predicted that the deficit was going to be whatever it may be, I don't know, $500 billion, and it's now only whatever it may be, $300 or $400 billion. We are making real progress on this. This is a trick that they do every single year. But the truth is that year after year, our deficits since Bush has been president are very, very high. The national debt has increased since he has been president by over $2.5 trillion. It's now over $8 trillion. And we've got, as we discussed a moment ago, a very serious problem in that regard.
Ann in Ada, Michigan on the line. Hey, Ann, welcome to the program. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, thank you. My question is, I live in Ada, Michigan, and we've got a political race here where a billionaire is running against our incumbent governor. And what I want to know is, how can normal people have a voice when millionaires and billionaires are gaining political power? And, for example, in our current political race here, the billionaire who's running has already spent $17 million of his own personal fortune, and there's still 7 weeks left in the election.
This is Dick DeVos, the guy who, the Amway fortune, who outsourced all the jobs to China, Ann?
I actually live in Ada, and I know a lot of people who have worked at that company, and, you know, I mean, I consider this campaign to be really, really misleading, and, you know, it bothers me.
Well, Ann, you raise a very, very profound question. And that is, in many ways, the very fabric of American democracy is really being challenged now by the fact that all over this country, Michigan is an example, Vermont, my race is another example, where people with huge sums of money are spending their money to buy elections. And I really don't believe that when people like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and these other guys who founded this country thought about the future of America, they did not anticipate that elections could be bought. But it is a real threat, I think, to American democracy when you end up with a situation where you have extraordinarily wealthy people not only controlling our economy, controlling the media, but on a day-to-day basis controlling the government of the United States. And it's not just that it's millionaires themselves or multimillionaires running for office. You have a lot of folks in Congress who are not millionaires but get their money from wealthy, powerful special interests. So the real issue that you are focusing on is money in politics. And I think if we don't address that issue, what you're going to end up with is the equivalent of a House of Lords, where just very, very wealthy people will be controlling what goes on in almost every aspect of our country. And that leads, of course, to campaign finance reform. I believe we need to move toward public funding of elections. which limit the amount of money that can be spent. If we don't do that, the trend is very clear that big money interests are going to be able to buy elections all over this country.
Mike, a new caller in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Bernie.
Hey, Don, Mike.
Yeah, I'm doing all right. My question is, in regard to the last caller, one of DeVos's ads says, I won't take any money from special interest. That's obvious because he is the special interest. My question is, do you think we can have a fair election in this country after they stole it in Florida last in 2000 and stole it again in Ohio in 2004? Do we have free elections, honest elections?
Well, I know that in the state of Vermont we do, and I think in most states we do. I think there is great concern. And, Tom, I don't know if you saw this. There was a piece that I read the other day about a study done at Princeton University. Did you see that?
You're talking about where they've easily hacked the Diebold machines?
Yeah.
Yeah, and flipped an election in an untraceable way.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bev Harris, in fact, did this also a couple of weeks ago. Just walked up to a machine and surreptitiously slipped a card into it, you know, because he put the cards in, and infected it with a virus that would change elections.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, what you and I have talked about this issue, and my own view on it is so long as there are doubts, we should move away from these machines until the problems can be resolved, if ever. And I'd rather see paper ballots. Take an extra hour to get the results, but make sure that everybody knows that their votes have been accurately counted.
And maybe we should rethink having secretaries of state, having the administrators of elections be political officials?
No. The goal is to get an election where everybody feels comfortable with the results.
Well said. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org, his website. Congressman Bernie Sanders from Vermont, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Tom. Take care.
Always a pleasure. It's 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Albert Einstein: the strength of the Constitution lies entirely in the determination of each citizen to defend it. Only if every single citizen feels duty-bound to do his share in this defense are the constitutional rights secure. Well said. By the way, I'm broadcasting live today from the Quake, KQKE, in San Francisco, a station which is going to be picking up this program starting Monday, day after today's Friday, so 3 days hence. And I'm here in San Francisco because tonight, Friday night, 7:30 at Modern Times, I will be doing a book signing at 888 Valencia. On Saturday, the September 16th, I'll be doing a book signing at Book Passage at 1 p.m. and in Corte Madera. And also on Saturday, I'll be doing a book signing at Black Oaks Books at 6 p.m. in Berkeley, California. This is for the new book, Screw the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Myron Abell is with us right now. Myron is the Director of Energy Policy with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank, I guess you would call it, CEI.org. Am I characterizing you accurately, Myron?
Sure, Tom, although I try not to do too much thinking here in Washington. It's, you know, it's not popular here.
Well, okay. Good joke. But this is something that you guys are clearly thinking about. You've written an article trashing or attacking or criticizing, let's say, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger for being willing to sign legislation imposing statutory limits on greenhouse gas emissions in the state of California. What's wrong with that?
Well, you know, California already has the highest electricity prices in the country, leaving aside Hawaii, and the highest gasoline prices. It has the lowest per capita energy consumption already. And that's one of the reasons it has a much weaker economy than a lot of the rest of the country. And now the
weaker, they represent 1/6 of the entire American economy.
Yes, but it's been growing more slowly, particularly if you take into account population growth. It's been growing more slowly than most of the rest of the country, not less than New England and New York, but less than most of it. And now we're going to have an energy squeeze that will make the one that's gone on for the last 15 or 20 years look like, you know, a party.
Give us the specifics of what Schwarzenegger is going to sign.
Well, it's a bill that would, and by the way, it was passed with basically all the Democrats voting for it and all the Republicans voting against it. So your listenership will probably know where to identify here. The bill would require them to, the California Air Resources Board to come up with programs and limits that will cut greenhouse gas emissions back to 1990 levels by 2020. They're estimating that will be about a 25% cut below business as usual.
Now, 2020, 14 years from now, Reuters is leading this story today. A leading U.S. climate researcher said on Wednesday the world has a 10-year window of opportunity to take decisive action on global warming and avert a weather catastrophe. NASA scientist James Hansen, widely considered the doyen of American climate researchers, said governments must adopt an alternative scenario to keep carbon dioxide emission growth in check. Myron, we're talking with Myron Abel of Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Here's the big question, I think. The goal of any business, including the oil companies, but I mean the goal of any business, is to try to internalize profits to the extent it's possible and externalize costs to the extent that it's possible. When those costs that are externalized get dumped on we the people, then really it becomes a form of corporate welfare, as it were. And usually, in most cases, we can figure out a way to say, okay, you know, you're doing this cost, you're using a certain amount of land or property, so we can figure out a way to tax it or whatever. But how do you, in the case of the oil companies, and basically the entire oil industry, the whole oil energy machine, not just in California, but in the United States and around the world, how can you possibly say to the oil companies that externalized cost of the destruction of the planet and of the lung cancers and other cancers that are caused by all these hydrocarbons and the byproducts of oil in the air and diesel fuel and everything else, how can you say to them that externalized cost is no problem, we'll all pick it up as the taxpayers, or we'll all pick it up with the death of the species? I don't get it.
Well, if I agreed with that the externalities are very large, I wouldn't get it either. I don't think the externalities are very large. But different.
You think James Hansen is wrong?
Yeah, I think Jim Hansen has got, well, for one thing, he's become absolutely obsessed by being seen as the leader of the pack on global warming.
Well, he's the head of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. The guy is not, you know, some kind of wacko. He works for George Bush.
Actually, I doubt that. You know, he said it in San Francisco last December at the American Geophysical Union meeting. He gave a paper and had a slideshow in which he says, unless human beings become extinct, there will never be another ice age. And that's how he now believes, he's got the CO2 religion. He thinks that carbon dioxide drives the climate. It does everything. Even, I mean, how can you believe that?
But what if he's right?
Well.
What if there's a 5% chance that he's right? Are you willing to risk that your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren are going to die miserable deaths or live in a society where the planet can feed maybe a half a billion people, but there are 6 billion people struggling to survive? On the chance that he might be right, but over the short term, hey, let's get some of the contributors to Competitive Enterprise Institute to jack up their profits.
Well, I think everybody has to take even very small risks into account. But I would put against that, I think you have to not do just a risk analysis, you have to do a risk-risk analysis. That is, you have to compare risks. And the risks of global warming policies are pretty astonishing. In Europe, which is signed under the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty, which is, after all, only step one. This is just the first of 30 steps that would be needed to meet the kind of target that Jim Hansen is talking about. And the first step is going to be the cheapest because everybody's going to make the cheapest cuts in emissions first. They have raised gasoline prices through raising the taxes to $7 a gallon, and yet since 1990, emissions, according to the European Environment Agency, since 1990, transport emissions have gone up 24% in those countries. So you've got
they've had substantial population growth in most of those countries.
No, not in the EU-15.
Actually, there has been, although it's mostly been through immigration.
But it's pretty small. It's not anywhere near 24%. But
okay, I'll give you that.
But, you know,
that raises the question of if that's the result of increased economic activity, because their economies have been growing, and over that period of time they probably have grown 24%, then is economic growth a good thing? Maybe we should be looking at trying to zero out economic growth.
Well, I think if you believe the kind of Hansen storyline, I think that's what you're going to get. And I think you have to also remember.
And what's wrong with that?
You mentioned population growth. A lot of the world, the EU-15 is pretty much stable in population now, and the projections are that it will start to decline fairly soon. But in the United States, we still have 1% per year population growth. Some countries have more than that. How are you going to cut energy use 60% in 44 years?
Nobody's suggesting cutting energy use, Myron Ebell. We're suggesting cutting fossil fuel-based energy use.
Well, let me put this in perspective. The International Energy Agency in Paris says that the world is going to use 60% more energy by 2030. Right now, 85%.
If it continues on the current trajectory.
Right, yeah, current economic growth.
Which nobody expects.
No, this is their projection given what they think the economy and world population is going to do. 85% of our energy currently comes from fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas. The International Energy Agency projects that in 2030, 85% of it will come from coal, oil, and natural gas, but there'll be 60% more of it. So this is a train wreck. If you really
shouldn't instead of trying to stop Schwarzenegger from cutting back on the use of fossil fuel, shouldn't we be encouraging him and saying, and by the way, how about some tax credits to develop alternative energy sources?
I think if you look at what's happening in various countries, the United States will actually lead the way to a technological transformation, but it won't be through putting ourselves on an energy diet. Let me compare emissions in this.
Again, country. I'm not talking about an energy diet. I'm talking about a fossil fuel diet. They're building wave power extraction machines off the coast of Oregon right now.
Yeah, and that's great. That's great. I'm for every kind of energy, but you know the fact is that we need it all. You can't turn the world energy economy around in 30 years.
But the average European is using 1/7 as much energy as the average American. Why can't we just change some of the ways of our life?
Well, we can if we have a command and control economy like North Korea or Cuba.
No, I'm talking about Germany and England.
Well, they're a lot poorer than we are. You know, people live in much smaller apartments. Most of them don't own cars. It's a class thing in Britain.
We'll have to wrap it up next time around. CEI.org, Myron Ebell, thanks for being with us. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, please, Mr. President, I voted for you. Not just one time, either. I think it was two. I like the way you said that you would throw away the key. But there's been some kind of error that came to get me. I need to call a lawyer to straighten this out. No one in here knows or cares what I'm talking about. When we threw out that habeas corpus and those trials, you see, wasn't that for the bad guys, not the good guys like me? Oh, please, Mr. Prison Guard, don't beat me again. Can't you see in other circumstances we could be friends? Won't you let me call my lawyer? I can call him at home. I ain't one of the bad guys, I'm Rodney Malone.
And welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Yeah, this is the problem. I mean, you change the laws so that absolute power accumulates in one place, and you never know. It might be turned on you like it was on Greg Palast last week when he was arrested by the Department of Homeland Security for taking pictures of people in FEMA trailers. God forbid anybody should learn about that. Victoria Jones is with us, our senior press conference correspondent with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. I didn't know Greg Palast had been arrested for that.
Yeah, he came on this program and told us about it. He went in with a camera crew. There's 70,000 people living in this giant FEMA concentration camp, basically. I mean, it's surrounded by fences with barbed wire at the top. There's only one way in and out. People are not allowed vehicles. They have to travel on the bus. The bus only goes to one place, and that's the local Walmart. And right next door to it is the second largest refinery in the United States by ExxonMobil, and one of the dirtiest, according to Greg Palast, belching out all these fumes. This is, you know, in what's sometimes referred to as Cancer Alley, I believe, onto these folks. And Greg Palast went down and did a film documentary of it for the BBC, and they charged him with the crime of photographing critical national infrastructure. And that's that is a 5 to 20 year felony.
Have they dropped the charge?
Not yet, but Exxon has, and it turns out that it was Exxon who made the original complaint to the Department of Homeland Security, which caused them to bring in him and his producer. And yesterday he sent me a note saying that Exxon has decided to withdraw their complaint because of the bad press they're getting from it.
But he
doesn't know yet whether or not, you know, I mean, once the process is started, it's no longer in Exxon's court. It's now in Homeland Security's court.
Right.
So, but the bigger issue, and the one I pointed out yesterday, is that Greg Palast is an award-winning New York Times best-selling author who is well-known, has a million readers of his website, and he came on my program and talked about it and other programs as well, and, you know, he could reach millions of people. That's not true of the average person listening to this program who might be curious about what's going on at FEMA, walk in and take a picture, or even one of the residents of these parks, and end up in jail. End up vanished, end up under the Patriot Act with no lawyer, not even knowing what the charges are against them, tossed into Guantanamo Bay for the next 5 years. I mean, they have changed our laws so much, this is like Pinochet's Chile now.
It's quite, I've got my mouth open.
It's
so
chilling.
Shocked by what you're telling me.
It is chilling. It is absolutely chilling. He could have been arrested, and nobody would have been, because it was under the Patriot Act, it was a terrorism violation. That he could have been arrested without being informed that he was being arrested. He could have been held indefinitely. He could have never been informed of the charges against him. He could have been denied a lawyer. He could have been denied the ability to contact anybody literally for the rest of his life. That's the law in the United States of America today.
It's absolutely terrifying.
It is.
It's terrifying. And
not only is it terrifying, it is wrong. This is not the America that the founders and framers of this country, the founders of this country and the framers of the Constitution fought and died for. This is not the America that I don't know how many generations it's been since this country was founded, but many, many, many generations of people have fought in wars to defend. This is not the America that I grew up in. This is not, and we'd been going over 200 years back then. This is an America that has become something very, very much like Vladimir Putin's Russia, and Bush looking into his eyes, seeing his soul and seeing a soulmate. I'm concerned.
I think you're right to be concerned.
Now, in the press conference this morning, I watched part of it. I'm doing the show here from the Quake in San Francisco, and they have a TV monitor in the studio with the text on the screen. And Bush was saying that the UN needs to get involved in Rwanda. What happened? I thought he hated the UN.
Well, he does hate the UN. He was asked a couple of questions about the UN, and but basically he was saying that nevertheless the stuff that the UN can do, and he felt that the UN should get involved in Darfur and that should take action on the genocide, which was probably one of the most positive things he said in the entire press conference.
Yeah, except that there's this cognitive dissonance. I mean, he's saying this at the same time that his UN guy, John Bolton, is doing everything he can to undermine the UN, and they're sending guys out to do talk shows like mine. We did this yesterday. The cons are sending these guys out. They're going on all the talk shows saying the U.S. should pull out of the UN.
Well, and we also are hearing that, that Bolton is pretty much saying we need to get reforms by the end of the year.
Yeah, and define reforms. I mean, basically gut the thing, you know.
Yeah.
Amazing.
He also said very interestingly, I am not a focus group, I'm encapsulated here.
Oh, my goodness.
which I think is a fascinating statement.
Yeah, it's a bit of a Freudian slip, or something.
Something, yes.
Beyond a Freudian slip.
Yes.
Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
There is a war between the rich and poor, a war between the man and the woman. There is a war between the ones who say there is a war and the ones who say there is one.
But don't you come on back to the war.
You tell him, Leonard. Leonard Cohen there. A great Canadian. There is a movie. You're My Man, I think, or I'm Your Man, or whatever. It's the new Leonard Cohen movie. I got to tell you, I saw that thing a couple months ago. Absolutely brilliant for old Leonard Cohen junkies like me. It was the thing to see. Welcome back to The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And should put the absolute nail in the coffin of the idea of the Washington Post as the liberal media. I mean, not only do the cons control the House, not only do the cons control the Senate, not only do the cons control the White House, not only do the cons control the Supreme Court, not only do they control the state houses and state senates, in many states all across the United States, and many of the governor's mansions. Not only do the big multinational corporations and defense contractors own all the major television networks, but now, and many of the radio companies, now the Washington Post has hired Michael Gerson. Michael, they've hired him to write op-ed pieces. And this is incredible. This guy, you ever heard of WIG? The White House Iraq Group, WHIG? This was the group that in 2002, was whipping up the war in Iraq. They were coming up with phony intelligence. They were cherry-picking legitimate intelligence and taking it out of context, stripping out of it the caveats and the, well, it might be, or this came from an unreliable source like Ahmad Chalabi, who's got a hidden agenda, you know, all this other kind of stuff. They took all that stuff and shoveled it out and were the cheerleaders for the war. And he was part of that, part of the White House Iraq group. But not just that. This is the guy who, according to Michael Isikoff and David Korn in their new book, Hubris, this is the guy who spun, well, as actually a brilliant piece by Jeff Cohen. Jeff Cohen, the former producer of The Donahue Show and the founder of Fair, Fairness, and Accuracy in Reporting over at commondreams.org. Right now you can read the thing. This is the guy in their new book, Hubris. Michael Isikoff and David Korn write, inserted references to the yellow cake from Niger tale into various Bush speeches, including the 2003 State of the Union, helped prepare Secretary of State Colin Powell's dishonest and bellicose speech to the UN, conceived Team Bush's trademark paranoid soundbite warning of a potential Iraqi nuclear program. The first sign of a smoking gun might be a mushroom cloud. Fact is, as Jeff Cohen notes, according to Hubris, the mushroom cloud line was intended for a Bush speech, but it was too good to hold. It was first deployed in September 2002 by anonymous White House aides in a New York Times front page scare story by, guess who? Judith Miller. I know you were just shocked to hear that. Warning that Iraq had stepped up its quest for nuclear weapons. That same day, Condoleezza Rice, part of the Condoleezza Rice, Judith Miller axis of disinformation, said, quote, "We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud." And this line that Michael Gerson came up with became a standard and manipulative war cry from then on, writes Jeff Cohen. He also notes that this is incredible. Speechwriter Gerson should be right at home at the Washington Post from the September 2002. Now, that was, again, remember, 2002, one of the guys back in August, one of the neocons in the White House was asked, are you guys going to, you know, start the drumbeat for a war with Iraq? I mean, is that what you're doing right now? This was in August of 2002. 2002, a midterm election year, just like this year. The last time we had a year just like this year, not a presidential election, but just, you know, everything else. That's called a midterm election. Every other 4 years, you have midterm elections. And the White House source, the neocon in the White House said, you don't roll out a product in August. You wait until September. And sure enough, starting in September, and by the way, look around, look at what's been happening the last couple of weeks. They rolled out their new product. Starting in September, they rolled out their product for the midterm elections. Fear, fear, and more fear. And say, you gotta be worried, or you're gonna get crazy. It's just incredible. As Russell Mokaber and Robert Weissman have documented, the Washington Post's op-ed page between September 2002 and February 2003, and remember the war was declared on March 19th, 2003, so this is September, October, November, December, January, February. This is the 6 months leading up to the war, including the 3 months leading up to the 2002 elections, which, frankly, in my opinion, was as much about that as anything else. In those 6 months leading up to the war, the Washington Post editorialized in favor of the Iraqi war 26 times. In fact, the Washington Post used words like fools and liars. Yes, those actual words, the word fool and the word liar, to describe skeptics of the war. To describe people who were saying, well, you know, maybe bombing the citizens of Iraq back to the Stone Age and occupying a foreign country might not be such a good idea. Oh, but there's oil to get. There's political capital to be earned. Come on, we gotta do this. Jeff Cohen notes, as Gerson's smoking gun mushroom cloud soundbite took flight, Al Gore made an Iraq speech questioning preemptive war. Preemptive war, you'll recall, the last time a major industrial power declared a preemptive war, a war to stop a threat before it materialized, was Adolf Hitler invading Poland. So Al Gore makes a speech in 2002, late 2002, As these guys are ginning up the war against Iraq, this preemptive war of choice. There was no threat. They knew there was no threat. They were lying to us through their teeth, and we now know that because we have the documents to prove it. Ranging from the Downing Street minutes and memos, the documents coming out of the United Kingdom, out of Whitehall. We know that Tony Blair was lying about it. He's all but admitted it, and people in his cabinet have admitted it. And we know that they were lying about it here. I mean, you've got the testimony of people like Paul O'Neill, the Secretary of the Treasury, ginning up this war as they were lying about it. Al Gore made a speech just questioning the whole concept of a preemptive war. On the Washington Post op-ed page, Gore's speech was described as, and these are in quotes, these are the actual words that were used on the op-ed page of the Washington Post to describe Al Gore for questioning the United States launching a war against a country that represented no threat to us, but had a whole heck of a lot of oil. On the op-ed page of the Washington Post, it was said that Gore's speech was, quote, dishonest, cheap, and low, end quote, and, quote, wretched, vile, and contemptible, end quote. Another column called it, quote, a series of cheap shots, end quote. On the other hand, when the Washington Post had an opportunity to opine about Colin Powell's speech at the UN, the one that Michael Gerson helped write, the one that he prepped Colin Powell for, Michael Gerson, the guy who's now got a job with the Washington Post as an op-ed writer, when Colin Powell gave that speech, the Washington Post ran a headline titled, Irrefutable. The Washington Post said, and I quote, it's hard to imagine how anyone could doubt that Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction, end quote. They even said that everyone from the right to the left embraced Powell's speech. As journalist Robert Perry noted, when reading the Washington Post's pre-war coverage, there was a whiff of totalitarianism in which dissidents never get space to express their opinions, but are still excoriated by the official media. When the state speaks, however, the same media hails the government's brilliance. Have we come into an era where the new rulers are... Do we have a new task? Do we have a new Pravda? Should the Washington Post be called the Washington Pravda? I mean, this is incredible. The Washington Post, ginning it up for the war, and then the Washington Post's op-ed page pumping the war, and the Washington Post saying, well, you know, he's joining the other conservatives here at the Washington Post. Isn't it a marvelous thing? I mean, this is just tragic. Absolutely tragic. 45 minutes past. We are watching the death of real journalism in the United States right before our eyes. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It's not the job of a satire queen to help a particular candidate raise some green. But we've got to help Tony Trupiano come through. Won't you help make a red district blue? Now that Mikado's not a vampire, you know, with a record like that, the guy's gotta go. Iraq and phony ethics reform. That's got his own little desert dust storm. Tony talks from a heartfelt place, and that's why he's gonna win this race. Tony will fight hard for Michigan's 11. So won't you be there for Tony on November 7th? So throw a few bucks Tony's way. Ask a few friends to listen to what he's got to say. Carl Levin, Lex, and Granholm, Stabenow, and Dingle, too. So won't you make a red district blue? Yeah, doesn't Congressman Tony sound sweet to you? Won't you help make a red district blue?
Oop, and Tony Trupiano, I'm sorry I didn't have the mic on there. I was hearing myself, but you weren't hearing me. Tony Trupiano, a new theme song for Tony's campaign. Tony, a great guy. He's running for Congress for Michigan. Tony was on the air with me back 4 years ago, going on 4 years ago, at the IE America Radio Network, the first liberal talk radio network. And he's done fill-in work for this program and others over the years, and he's a great guy, and he's running for Congress now. TonyTrupiano.com is his website, and, you know, support him. Check it out. He's a great guy. He's been on this program. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Dan in Seattle. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. First-time caller.
Well, thanks for calling, Dan.
Okay. I don't know if you saw this on Democratic Underground yesterday, but it was a report about the Federal Communications Commission had issued a study about media consolidation and, of course, you know, big conglomerates buying local news outlets.
Yeah, and a lawyer is now saying, well, here's the story from the Associated Press for our listeners. Let me just read a little bit of it, and then you and I can talk about it.
Sure.
John Dunbar wrote it. The Federal Communications Commission ordered its staff to destroy all copies of a draft study that suggested greater concentration of media ownership would hurt local TV news coverage. A former lawyer at the agency says the report, written in 2004, came to light during the Senate confirmation hearing for FCC Chairman Kevin Martin, who is the Republican guy. Senator Barbara Boxer, a Democrat from California, received a copy of the report indirectly from someone within the FCC who believed the information should be public, according to Boxer's spokeswoman. And Adam Canadub, now a law professor at Michigan State University, said senior managers at the agency ordered that, quote, every last piece, end quote, of the report be destroyed. Quote, the whole report was just stopped, end of discussion, end quote, he said. Kenny, he was a lawyer in the FCC's media bureau at the time the report was written and communicated with its authors. And in a letter sent to Martin Wednesday, Boxer said she was dismayed. Oh, here's the bottom line of the report. They analyzed 4,078 individual news stories broadcast by TV stations in 1998. And what they found, the analysis showed local ownership of television stations adds almost 5.5 minutes to local news, of local news to broadcast, and more than 3 minutes of on-location news to local broadcast. The conclusion is at odds with the FCC's arguments that they made in 2003 when they said that a company could own several TV stations in the same market, no big deal, all that kind of thing. So that's the frame. That's the story. Your comments, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, if all politics are local and we rely upon our local news vehicles to help inform us of our, you know, political meetings and the outcomes of committee reports and the like at a local level, it's just absolutely amazing that the FCC would support this destruction of our local news vehicles in their conveyance of that information.
Yeah, and the destruction of a report that points it out.
Yeah,
this is
exactly.
Particularly... Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, exactly. I mean, and this isn't the first time this administration has done something like this.
No, and this is particularly important with regard to television and newspapers. It's
absolutely.
Because when this country was founded, from day one, The post office was created not to deliver mail. Ben Franklin's idea of creating the post office, and it was created within a year of the creation of this country as a federal agency. The post office was created not to deliver the mail. It was created to deliver newspapers.
Yep.
There was a special subsidy provided to newspapers for that delivery. In other words, the government of the United States actually paid more to deliver newspapers than it cost. That
right.
was a subsidy. We offered a subsidy on the cost of newsprint to newspapers. That's how important they felt that newspapers are. And local ownership of them. The Sherman Act in 1881 was intended in part to, in reaction to some of the media empires that were growing, particularly the guy who owned San Simeon, the William Randolph Hearst, this giant megalomaniac who said to McKinley, give me a war and I'll give you the PR. So we have, from the very beginning, we've recognized the importance of local newspapers and local news. And television is the other place. I mean, television and newspapers are the main places where people get like 80-90% of their news. And the more that they're in local hands, the better. I suppose you could make the argument for radio as well. I got a dog in that fight, but it is so clear, though, in this study with the FCC about television that we really should be reconsidering this. I think at the very least we need to have a national debate about it, a national dialogue. Let's talk about this stuff. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Ed in Del Mar, New York, sends a note here while we're on the air. He says, just listening to our friend Rush, he's going on and on about how he has been hearing about internal Republican polls that are showing that many of the key congressional races are quickly shifting toward the GOP's favor, even though the official newspaper polls are showing something quite different. Yeah. Are we... You know, the polls were always accurate until 2000. They were always accurate until Karl Rove got into this game. Until Niccolo Machiavelli got into this game. Well, after the next break, I'm going to share with you a story that Brad Friedman has just broken about, Bernie Sanders, in fact, mentioned it in the first hour, about what can be done with these voting machines. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there's a whole entire industry out there devoted to stealing elections. In the meantime, the Republicans are also trying to steal science. No, you heard it right. They're trying to steal science. The Catholic Church did it for 500, 600, 700, 800 years, quite successfully, I might add. And the Republicans are having some successes as well. Chris Mooney is with us. He's the author of The Republican War on Science, new book. His website, waronscience.com. He just did a gig over at Powell's Books in Portland. So those of you listening in Portland, Oregon, you can get over to Powell's and pick up his book. It's available at powells.com online as well as other fine book sources all over the country. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you with us. Why would any political party want to declare war on science? Science is not political. It's objective.
You would think and hope so, but the reason this party wants to declare war on it is because they have to appease their political base, and their political base wants to declare war on it. So here we're talking about the religious conservatives. They want to attack evolution. They want to attack embryonic stem cell research. They want to fight over contraception, things like that. And then there's regulated industry or big business, and they want to attack global warming, mercury pollution, endangered species protections, and so forth and so on. And now we've got a government that's responsive to all those attacks.
I would guess, frankly, that while the former, you know, the religious right might be the more visible of the special interest groups, probably the more powerful of the two is the coalition of big oil companies and chemical companies and you know, basically the polluting industries.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say. I am most concerned by the attacks on climate science because with global warming, literally the whole world is at stake. But if you jump over the religious right and you take the attack on evolution and you look at that, well, in some ways it's more fundamental because they want to reject the entire scientific process and they want to include supernatural explanations within science.
Yeah.
So that would redefine the whole nature of what science is in the first place.
I had James Lovelock on my local program yesterday morning. He has a new book out about the Gaia. He's the guy who invented the Gaia hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called.
We share a publisher.
Uh-huh, good.
Yes.
I believe his new book is called The Revenge of Gaia. As I recall, I don't have it in front of me. I'm not in my normal studio right now. But it was a very bleak interview, frankly. I mean, he was saying that there is nothing that can be done at this point. The global warming has reached the point where positive feedback loops have begun and they can't be stopped. By sequestering carbon, he said you'd have to pull out of the atmosphere every year if you were to turn carbon into carbon carbonate. Calcium carbonate, you know, like tungsten, you know, which is carbon bound up with calcium. It would have to be a mile high and a mile square at the base, a giant pyramid of carbon every year, and it's just not practical. But he did say that there was one possible solution, and that was, you know, they take sulfur out of petroleum to make jet fuel. He said if we put the sulfur back into the petroleum and had all the planes continue to fly exactly the way they are right now, but with a certain amount of sulfur added to the jet fuel, it would inject sulfur into the stratosphere and would reflect sunlight back out into outer space and reduce the amount of sunlight coming to the Earth and compensate for the global warming.
And probably give us more acid rain.
Well, you know, I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't know how long the sulfur is going to last in the stratosphere. Yeah, he said there would be all kinds of unintended consequences. But, you know,
right.
It's like it's reached the point where he said you know, starting between 2030 and 2060, we're going to see major desertification of the regions from the equator as far north as New York City, where plant life, where the summers will be so hot that they will simply kill off the plant life and it won't recover.
Well, he, you know, he's giving you a very bad case scenario.
Yeah.
And members of the scientific community, you know, working on this subject are not all quite as pessimistic as he is. So, for example, James Hansen at NASA thinks we still have a little bit of
time. Yeah, he says we have 10 years.
Before we get to the tipping point. Yeah. The thing is, no one knows exactly where the tipping point is. And once you get there, it's really bad because feedbacks can kick in. So, you know, you melt ice at the Arctic and then the Earth absorbs more.
Well, this was the story that the AP carried a few weeks ago about the escaping methane in the northern regions. That, you know, methane is 26 times more potent than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. So you only, you know, one ton of methane gas has, you know, you'd have to have 26 tons of methane. 26 tons of carbon dioxide to equal the global warming impact of 1 ton of methane, and the methane is now starting to bubble out of the Arctic regions from ancient peat bogs that are melting at a rate 5 times faster than was anticipated.
Well, yes, all this stuff is terrifying, and we don't know how bad it's going to be, how fast.
And in the midst of this, the Republicans are launching a concerted war. I mean, I had one of these guys on the program earlier, Myron E. Bell from the Competitive Enterprises.
Oh,
I opened
him.
The program with
he's
it.
He's a very nice guy. Completely
yeah.
Disagree with him, though.
Yeah, he's a very nice guy, and, you know, part of his paycheck comes from ExxonMobil. I mean, you know, they're one of the supporters of the Competitive Enterprises.
Exactly,
too.
Yeah.
I don't understand how these people can sleep at night.
Well, it's been a systematic attempt to sort of attack the science. When any new study comes out, or especially when something like Al Gore's movie comes out, something that really looks like it might have the potential to change opinion, then the think tanks of the political right go into overdrive and they start attacking. They start firing out all these press releases and, you know, critiques of studies and so forth. That's what they do.
Their job
is to fight over the science.
We're talking with Chris Mooney. He's the author of the new book, The Republican War on Science, waronscience.com, the website. And available in bookstores all across the country. Chris, I know that they've had some successes. Bush vetoed the stem cell legislation. That's not happening. The United States, Bush pulled us out of the Kyoto Accord that Clinton had, I don't know if he'd signed it or if he'd set it up to sign, but Clinton was going to sign, you know, it was going to go forward here in the United States. So, you know, they've had, over the last 5-6 years, some significant successes. Are they gaining in strength, or are they beginning to peter out? Are Americans beginning to see through this and see that these are just a bunch of greedy folks looking out for their own self-interests?
On one level, I don't expect much change from the Bush administration. But I am heartened by the fact that this critique of the war on science, which I've made, is really catching on. You know, you find Democrats talking more and more about science. I heard General Wesley Clark, I was on a panel with him at the yearly COS convention, give a just incredibly powerful speech about the importance of science to the national future. And that's just one example. So I think that people are realizing this is a big issue. And maybe even the president is realizing he's a little vulnerable on this sort of thing, because he actually included science in his State of the Union speech in 2006.
In what context?
He talked about, well, he doesn't acknowledge criticisms, right? But he says, oh, we need to beef up our competitiveness in science, you know.
Yeah, because I'm assuming usually when Bush talks about science, he's talking about Star Wars.
No.
Military science.
No, in this case he was saying, oh, you know, we need to maintain global competitiveness in science, which is a way of saying something nice about science without acknowledging that he has a real science problem in terms of his administration's criticism.
What can Americans do to stop the Republican war on science, Chris?
Well, there's lots of things that we can do, and I think that most immediately, let's oppose the politicians who are the worst on matters of science. In other words, let's apply the principle that if you mislead the public about science, you should be voted out of office, just like if you mislead the public about the causes of war or the percentage of attacks.
Who are the worst misleaders? I mean, George Bush is not running for re-election. Who are the worst misleaders that we should be working against?
Well, you know, a lot of them are listed in my book. So Senator Inhofe, for example, heading the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works, has likened the whole global warming notion to a hoax. That's pretty outrageous. You know,
he's from Oklahoma, is he not?
Yes, that's right.
Any chance that he's not even up for re-election this year, is he?
You know, that is a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah,
I'm just sort of picking out some of the...
Okay.
Santorum in Pennsylvania has been, you know, one of the leading promoters of the attack on evolution.
Yeah.
And so you've got to go one by one, issue by issue, but there's lots of them out there.
Yeah, so the Republican War on Science, waronscience.com, I'm assuming a lot of this information at your website there?
Oh, absolutely.
Great. Chris Mooney, the author of the Republican War on Science, waronscience.com, and it is real. It is real, my friends. It is out there, and they are coming to get us. They don't want us to know the truth. They don't want us to know about science. They don't want us to know what's really going on, and it's not a healthy thing. It's just absolutely not a healthy thing. Chris, thanks a lot for writing this book.
Thanks for having me on the air.
Appreciate it. Cool. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. What are your thoughts on the war on science? Well, really, yeah, it's a Friday. Anything you want to talk about, give us a shout. Our phone number, 866-440-8466. Right here on the Tom Hartman radio program, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
I heard a voice. I thought it was God. It said,
You're wrong, and your sister is wrong.
It was so scary. I was so terrified. That morning I decided it was time to change sides. I'm a Republican now. The party elect. I'm a Republican now.
I got red on my staff.
I'm a Republican now.
We ain't having no sex.
I'm holier than now. I'm a Republican now.
And welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. One person at a time, one radio station at a time, one day at a time. Step by step here, regardless of the outcome of the elections this fall. And of course, we all need to get as active as we can, whether it's sending $25 or $50 to somebody or even $5 to a good candidate, or whether it's showing up at a local Democratic Party office and saying, hey, give me 2 city blocks and I'll go knock on doors. Give me some of that literature to pass out. Putting a sign in your front yard. It's a given that you're going to vote, right? In the midterm elections. I mean, no matter what it may be, because every single seat in the House of Representatives is up for re-election right now. Every single one. And a third of the Senate is up for re-election. Because the House of Representatives, people only have 2-year terms. In the Senate, they have 6-year terms, and they stagger them. So, you know, every 2 years there's an election. And so you get, you know, well, every 6 years anyhow, the senators get a re- So a third of the Senate is always up for re-election in every one of every other year election cases. So let's get out there and get active. And even if the Republicans retain control of the House and Senate, which frankly wouldn't surprise me given all the shenanigans, I still believe there is a strong, that the tide is turning. There is a strong awakening happening in America. And there's frankly a revulsion. I mean, when you have Lindsey Graham and John McCain and John Warner, 3 veterans, 3 Republicans, 3 conservatives, standing up in the United States Senate and saying to George Bush, no, your policy of promoting torture is turning America into Burma. We're not going to allow it. I mean, they didn't use those words, but we're not going to allow it. Functionally the same thing. It is, I just see this as a really healthy sign. I see it as a good thing. Barbara in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Barbara, what's on your mind today?
Good morning. Then I agree. There has to be some repudiation of him.
Yeah. I think frankly there is all across America. You know, whether we can succeed in demonstrating that at the ballot box is still to be found out. But even whether we do or whether we don't, we can't stop speaking out.
Well, I was calling this morning, Tom, to chuckle with you over the Republican attempt to say that the whole Valerie Plame CIA leak made up by the Democrats incident is all over because Armitage has admitted that he was the original source. Well, wait a minute.
Armitage worked in this administration.
The crimes with Cheney and Scooter happened a full 2 weeks before Novak even talked to Armitage, and that's not what the investigation's about.
Yeah. No, I mean, the Republicans are trying to reinvent history once more. Once more, Barbara.
I'm glad Fitzgerald has all the facts.
Yeah, I just hope he does something with them. I am concerned that he, being a lifelong Republican, is well tuned to the political process. And if he does anything, if another shoe is going to fall, it's not going to fall until like November 15th.
You know? Oh no.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I don't think the elections are going to turn on this issue in any case, but we'll see. Barbara, thanks for spreading the good word and caring enough to call into the program. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you.
Bye.
Dorothy in British Columbia. Hey, Dorothy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. I'm fine. Thank you.
Yeah,
what's
I'm
up?
Excited to be able to talk to you. I've been doing a lot of studying on the science of global warming, and something that isn't being talked about is the effect that increased carbon dioxide levels have on plant life. Right now we're at 380 parts per million. In another 10 years, at the rate we're going, we're going to be up to 400 parts per million. And at that point, according to a study done in Duke University and then again in the University of Michigan, there's the National Science Foundation published an article about this on April 12, 2006. But increased big levels of carbon dioxide, like above 400 parts per million. I'm sorry, I'm talking so fast. That affects the growth of plants. They begin to lose their ability to absorb nitrogen from the soil. Which
right. Plants are, there's a very delicate balance here, very delicate homeostasis. I write about this in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And so
oh, all right. I'm sorry about that.
No, it's fine. It's
no,
quite all right.
Did you also mention then that above 400 parts per million that
yes,
they can't absorb carbon dioxide?
That's right. They did some studies where they actually artificially sprayed carbon dioxide on, I believe it was trees. And what they found was that initially, at fairly low increase levels, it increased their growth. At higher levels, it decreased their growth because it screwed up their systems with relation to other things. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm shopping for a trailer and another new gun. I'm a Republican now. Criticism is swags. I'm a Republican now. And nobody checks. I'm a Republican now. We still ain't having no sex. I'm holier than now. I'm a Republican now. I'm a Republican now.
I'll learn the Washington flop.
I'm a Republican now.
It's time to plow in my crop.
I'm a Republican now.
Drink scotch till I drop.
I'm holier than now. I'm a Republican now. I'm a Republican now.
Indeed, 34 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. Tom Hartman here with you. March 6th, 2003. George W. Bush. Zarqawi is a man who was wounded in Afghanistan, received aid in Baghdad, ordered the killing of a U.S. citizen, USAID employee, was harbored in Iraq. September 23rd, 2004, George W. Bush. Saddam is a man who harbored terrorists, Abu Abbas, Abu Nidal, Zarqawi. July 17th, 2004, Saddam was a threat because he provided safe haven for a terrorist like Zarqawi. Now, setting aside the logic that, for example, George Bush was a threat because he provided safe haven for a terrorist like Mohammed Atta, I mean, just because somebody happens to be in your country, does that mean that you should be taken out as leader? Setting aside the logic from that, here's where it gets really bizarre. The Senate Intelligence Report last week, signed off on by the Republican, Pat Roberts, the chairman of the committee, as well as the Democrats, said that, and I quote, Saddam Hussein did not have a relationship with, harbor, or turn a blind eye towards Zarqawi. Zarqawi was up in the north under the no-fly zone where Saddam Hussein couldn't get to him. We were protecting him with our aircraft. So he had nothing to do with Saddam Hussein, and that's the official Senate intelligence report finding. No relationship with, did not harbor, didn't turn a blind eye to, yet you have three quotes here from Bush on June 17th, 04, September 23rd, 04, March 6th, 03, saying that Zarqawi and Hussein, you know, that Hussein should be held responsible because Zarqawi was in his country. So today, ABC News reporter Martha Raddatz says to Bush, why do you keep saying that Saddam had relations with Zarqawi when the Senate intelligence report says there was no relation? And Bush replies, and I quote, I never said there was an operational relationship. He just comes right out and lies. I mean, in the face of, how does he think he can do this when it's on the record what he has said in the past? I'm just boggled by it. I'm just boggled by it. I don't know how to, you know, beyond that. I just wake up, America. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Susan in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Susan, listening on KRXA. What's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm great, and I'll get better. What's up?
Well, it's been a long time since I've called, but I do listen.
Oh, good.
You know, and I do send emails. Anyway, Tom, you have this thing about the middle class and the 50s, and you talk about going back and bringing back that time. And my experience...
I don't want to bring back that time. I just want to bring back that economy.
That economy. Well, my experience growing up in the 50s was that it wasn't a safe time at all for me. I lived in a small town. I was a product of a Greek father and a Jewish mother. There was threats of, you know, being called a communist all around if you stuck out. I was a dirty Jew and a Christ killer every day of my life. I watched my neighbor being crucified because somebody called him a communist. This was a professor of 28 years, a physics professor at Rutgers University, beloved by all his students and the faculty, lost his job, died, you know, because he was building houses, got a heart attack. It was a rough time. It was a scary time. If you were in the mainstream, which I suspect you as a child might have been, well, you were just born around then. I was, you know, 9 years old or so when McCarthy did his thing. I used to rush home from school. Of course, I was unique. I don't know why I did this. At lunchtime, and I would listen to those hearings. And to me, it was all real clear what was going on. And I know that nobody around me understood that except maybe my parents.
Yeah.
And it was just such a tight, constricted time. People were afraid to step out of line. The clothes reflected it. The clothes that we wore, the corsets, you know, crinolines and all that. There really wasn't much movement, upward mobility among the lower middle class, you know. And I feel kind of maybe we never really did anchor in the middle class at that time.
It got pretty solid. We had by 1960, you had roughly 70% of American workers had a good solid middle class income.
Well, they had a good income enough to buy homes, but I don't know how good that was. And there was certainly a difference between my neighborhood and a neighborhood 3 miles away in Hempstead, New York, you know, where my cousins lived, where it was all, you know, beautiful, rich, big houses, lawns, and all of that.
I get your point, Susan.
Yeah.
And mine, you know, I was born in 1951, so I remember the 50s as a very young child. I remember the 60s very well, when it was, in many ways, just the exact opposite of that. People were stepping out and saying, no, we're not going to take this anymore.
We said, no, I couldn't wait for the 50s to end.
Yeah, but the 60s and 70s were really the high point of the American middle class. But in any case, my point is that I'm not, you know, one of these, American today, we got to do young whippersnappers. No, I'm not doing that.
No, you're not like that.
What I'm saying is that the rules, the economic rules of the game, and yes, there were some very flawed ones, we had apartheid in the United States during
that
period of time. I mean, it got undone in the 1960s to some extent, but it's still there, in fact.
Right.
But the reality is that the fundamental legal economic rules of the game did give labor a hand up, give labor a lot of power in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Right. It did, but I also see, are we still there?
Yeah.
I also see that the things are opening up and that maybe we have needed this giant downfall, this, horrific.
Oh, it was the Great Depression that caused Americans to turn to Franklin Roosevelt.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I'm reluctant to say it out loud, I really am. That things have to get really, really bad before enough Americans are going to get enough upset that they're going to try and make them good, because I hope eternally that we can get them good without a lot of suffering.
Yes.
But maybe that's what's going to happen. I don't know.
Criminally insane, and people are still giving him credence.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Susan, and I thank you for the call and for the point you made. I think it's a good point, and this is the kind of thing that in some ways we can go around and run in circles forever, and other ways, it's just as clear as the nose in your face, or you use an old cliche, but the bottom line is we need to, if we're going to have a strong democracy in America, we have to have a strong middle class and a free press. And ever since 1980, when Ronald Reagan came into office, the conservatives have been systematically going about the process of dismantling the middle class and dismantling the free press. And now the latest assault on this, Senator Gordon Smith and his henchmen leading the charge to do away with network neutrality on the Internet, because it's the last bastion of free speech out there. And it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy. And we need to be doing something about it. Hans in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Hans, or is it Hans?
Hans.
Hey, Hans. What's up?
Just a quick story regarding the reinstituting of tariffs in this country. I went down to buy some bearings for a woodworking machine that I own, that I use in my business.
Yeah.
Went into U.S. Bearing Company, and they had my bearings in stock, and he goes to look for them. Comes back with the price, $150 for four bearings, very high price. Said, what's going on here? And he said, well, these things are not made here, and U.S. Bearing doesn't make bearings anymore. And he goes and gets my bearings. Where are these bearings made? Japan and Italy.
Yeah.
Now, these are not poor countries.
No,
they
I know.
Have a higher standard of living than we have.
Yeah, my dad, worked in a tool and die shop from 1956 until the day he retired about maybe 8 or 10 years ago. And I remember back in the 70s or the 80s, I was still living at home. It must have been actually maybe even the late 60s. The tool and die business really started to take a hit. I mean, their major customer was General Motors, which was right there in Lansing, Michigan, just literally right up the street from their tool and die shop. This is a 13-man tool and die shop. When the Italians started importing, started competing with them, and in part it was because the Italian government was giving it subsidies, and in part it was because we were starting to change our tariff laws.
Well, it just shows that we've been sold down the river. We have to be producing these things, and we need tariffs to keep the jobs here in the United States.
I agree. And it's such a shame that so many politicians are afraid of that word, because I think that they need to embrace it. I really do. We need Hans, thanks for the call. We need a mass mobilization of pro-tariff people. But so many people have been duped by that billionaire Thomas Friedman and his book "The World Is Flat" and the Olive and the Lexus Tree. It's crazy. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I
see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And welcome back. My dad's favorite song. Anyway, thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Alex Goldmark, Lauren Kirchner, Andrew Dunn this week at Air America Radio, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society, Radio Power and RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room and on our message board, on our blog over there. And to Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, which we've had to put on hold for a couple of weeks, the most recent ones, because our server, we filled up, and we've got to get some more server space, because we've got something like 200 gigabytes of audio sitting over there right now, and we've hit a limit, so we're trying to change servers. That'll take a week or so. And to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our programs. Thanks so much for sticking with us. It's much appreciated. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Dick in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Dick, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, you know, about that so-called free press, you know, we've now clearly seen, I think, that the major networks like ABC, who happens to own the History Channel, they're obviously acting as mostly as a propaganda tool for the Republican Party. And that party now only seems to operate as a corporate lobbyist organization supporting unelected administrations who in turn function as a corporate crime syndicate gone global, you know. I think the biggest threat to us all isn't so much the Cheney administration or their Republican support base, but their media enablers. And I think the best way to try to regain some control of at least the audio media is to start our own rating service that actually pays enough money to get near 100% participation, so we don't get mostly conservatives doing the ratings, you know? We also need to know just what Democrats and liberals want to hear on the radio, since they constitute, I believe, a bulk of the audience, and the consumers, they're ignored now, except on
America.
I think that
process is happening right now, Dick. I frankly don't think that, for example, Arbitron, the radio rating folks, have any kind of political agenda at all. I mean, they're just doing the best they can to figure out who's listening to the radio. But the fact of the matter is that in those markets, well, let me just finish. The fact of the matter is that in those markets where you have a well-run radio station on what in the radio business is called a big stick, on a good signal, you know, on a where a lot of people can easily hear it, progressive talk radio does really well. As I mentioned the other day, in Seattle, this program, the number one talk show in Seattle, in Portland, we're doing very, very well. We compete between one and two, the number one and two slot in Portland, because it's on a 25,000-watt station. Around the country, the biggest correlation between success and not success has to do with the size of the signal that it's on, and frankly, the conservatives got a lot of the legacy stations, the big 50,000-watt stations to begin with. The size of the stations that, because they've been doing it for 15, 18 years,
and
the size of the station it's on,
yeah.
and the commitment of the management and the competence of the management to promote the station and to image the station and do all those things that you do in radio to make it work really well. And we have a lot of affiliates that we're working with very aggressively to improve the quality of our program and to improve the quality, you know, and to help promote our program on their station and help promote other programming on their station. I'm very committed not just to the Tom Hartman program, which we're in our fourth year now, but also to this entire format of progressive talk radio, and I'm seeing it grow. I'm seeing it grow and become stronger across the United States. The problems of in New York City notwithstanding, I think that that's frankly a fluke, and it has to do with, you know, some bad business decisions that were made 3 years ago that are now coming home to roost, and I think it's all remediable. I think it can all be fixed. And I have great confidence in the future. And frankly, I have a lot of confidence in Jim Wiggott, the guy who's running Air America Radio right now. I've met him. and had lunch with him down in San Francisco a couple months ago. Well, I'm in San Francisco right now, and met him again in New York. And I think that this guy's a real businessman, and he's gonna run the business like a business. And God bless him. I'm frankly optimistic. Rami in Bakersfield, California. Hey, Rami, what's up?
Hi, how are you doing, Tom?
I'm fine.
Yes, I want to get your opinion on one issue, and then I have another comment about the current gas prices.
Okay, well, we've only got about 50 seconds before we have to wrap this up.
What do you think about nationalizing the gas and oil industry? Do you think that's a good idea?
I don't think that nationalizing the industry is a good idea. I do think that saying that the oil that they're sucking out of the ground, which is ours, which was already nationalized, it's us, on public lands, that the law that was passed during the Clinton administration that said when the price of oil goes over $50, they no longer have to pay royalties on that oil, it's free. I think that's wrong, and I think that the gas and oil industry, and it's one of the reasons why they're showing record profits for any, ExxonMobil had a profit last quarter that was greater than any corporation in the history of the planet, even in inflation-adjusted dollars. I mean, bigger than the British East India Company. I think that what we should be saying is if you're taking the oil out of public lands, you have to pay us, we the people, for it. Thank you very much. You had a second one. Is it a quickie, Rami?
Yes, Tom, I got another question here. I'm really suspicious right now of the gas prices going down so much as we get closer and closer.
It's going to happen. Rami, we talked about it on the program before that there is an absolute correlation. Every time Bush's approval ratings go down, a few weeks later, gas prices go down, and then his approval ratings go back up. They are going to drive gas prices down to $1.95 a gallon by election day. Mark my words, I'll be within 20 cents of that. To get the Republicans reelected so that gas won't be an issue, and then it's going to spike back up again in November or December. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.